thank you very much for the kind invitation. So here in Italy is evening, but it's full midday in your country. So, well, it's really a pleasure to present this work here in front of you. The talk I'm going to give is divided basically in two parts. The first part, it's I will introduce you what we already know pretty well about black hole formation. It's very established. So some recent results done by myself and also by collaborators, where I think we have a clear scenario about formation of primordial black hole in the radiation-dominated universe, which is the very standard scenario now. But in the second part of the talk, I will discuss some very recent results. One paper is already published, one is coming out next week, where I'm going to focus on the possibility that primordial black hole are formed during a particular epoch of the early universe, which is the QCD phase transition. Because as we will see in this epoch, the object that could form could give rise to signal that maybe we are already detecting, but we don't know yet that these are primordial black holes. So let me start. So first of all, let me give you a very brief historical introduction about what is a primordial black hole. So primordial black hole are black holes formed in the very early universe. This is an old idea belonging to Zeldovich and Novikov in the late 60s and Stephen Hawking in the early 70s. So the early universe, as all of you know, is characterized by a simple equation of state, which is the equation of state for photons when the fluid is completely dominated by relativistic particles. So the pressure is just equal to the total energy density over 3. And it's interesting to know historically that this idea that Stephen Hawking was thinking about in 1971, and he published a very small qualitative, very short qualitative paper in Monthly Notices, triggered his thinking in thinking about the possibility that primordial black holes could be also quantum objects, because the size of the black hole goes like the mass. And so if the mass is small enough, you could have that the size of a black hole could be as small as a particle. And primordial black hole has the characteristic feature that there is no a lower limit, like in the astrophysical black hole, which is the Chandrasekhar mass. So depends on how early you form them, basically. And so this idea triggers Stephen Hawking to consider the possibility of combining quantum effects to black holes. And he discovered the fact that black holes evaporates with the rate of evaporation going like the inverse of the mass. And the basic results applied to primordial black hole is that if these objects have a mass which is smaller than 10 to the 15 grams, which is 10 to the minus 18 solar mass, they should be already evaporated by now, because the rate of evaporation would be shorter than the current age of the universe. In other words, if primordial black hole exist and are around in the universe, they should be at least larger than this threshold mass limit. The important thing to understand about primordial black hole formation is that because we are considering a radiation-dominated universe, it's not possible with such an equation of state to have a virialized structure, because there is no rest mass density component. With such an equation of state, the only thing that can happen is that if the amplitude of the perturbation collapsing is larger than a threshold, you would form a primordial black hole. If it's below the threshold, the perturbation will just bounce and disperse into the surrounding medium. And Bernard Carr, a PhD student of Stephen Hawking at that time, was the first one making a first estimation of this threshold. Making a Newtonian Jeans length argument, he just estimated that goes like the sound speed square, which is one of the order one third. And so this already tells you an important thing, that the perturbation we are considering here for forming primordial black hole are non-linear perturbation in the, so they could not be the small perturbation that you measure during the CMB typically. So first, the basic scenario is that you have a mechanism like inflation producing a field of cosmological perturbation, which we know that after inflation, this perturbation have a typical landscape which is much larger than the cosmological horizon, and then with the expansion of the universe, they re-enters at different epochs within the cosmological horizon, and eventually, if they are large enough, collapsing. So this sketch is basically showing the fact that depending on when this perturbation re-enters the cosmological horizon during the radiation dominant epoch, this gives you the typical mass scale of the perturbation that you form. So as you can see here, you have basically a field of peaks of different heights, and just the largest one would collapse and form a primordial black hole of different masses depending on when the collapse happens. As I was mentioned already before, the typical perturbation, perturbation that you observe during the CMB have a typical amplitude of 10 to the minus 5. This sketch is intended with having on the horizontal axis the Fourier modes. So this means that the typical amplitude for having of the amplitude order 1 should be much larger, which means that we are in the tail of the distribution of cosmological perturbation. And as I will show you later, this means that in the power spectrum cosmological perturbation, to really have enough primordial black hole to be cosmologically relevant, you need to have some kind of feature, which is not what we observe at the CMB scale. So that's the scenario that we have in mind. So here on this slide, I'm showing just very old results from my very early works when I was still a PhD student and young postdoc. So I developed during my PhD a personal code in spherical symmetry where I'm studying, so it's a full GR spherically symmetric code studying the collapse of a single perturbation within an expanding universe with a varying equation of state, which the typical one is the radiation. It's the one for radiation. So here you can see in this plot here, you see the basically what happens. So this is the typical 2m over r ratio, the compaction function. So here you see the condition that in spherical symmetry you need to achieve for the formation of an apparent horizon. So here you see basically the dashed line are the initial condition. So we have an overdensity within a certain scale compensated by an underdensity outside. So the overdensity in the center basically corresponds to a peak in the local compaction function, which you see this plot corresponds to just a perturbation which is just above the critical threshold for a very small amount. And so you can see the very typical mechanism of critical collapse, where you have the perturbation initially expanding with the universe, then re-entering the cosmological horizon, and having a very fine-tuned collapse where the region, while it's collapsing, is spreading matter outside at a nearly constant compactness. That's because you are very so close to the threshold that basically gravity and pressure gradients, which act in different direction, are very in a very fine-tuned action, counteraction. In the end, if you're over the threshold, you have the gravity wins and the peak grows up to one corresponding to the condition for formation of an apparent horizon where you have the black hole. Then you can do several simulations of like this with different amount, different perturbation amplitude, which means a different value of delta minus delta C, and you get a mass spectrum given by this very nice critical scaling law relation where the mass is just proportional to delta minus delta C to the power gamma, where gamma just depends on the equation of state for radiation is 0.36. And then MH is the mass of the cosmological horizon at horizon crossing, which is just the normalizing scale, just fixing the typical scale of the black hole. And then you have two parameters depending on the particular initial configuration. The threshold that I will show you later depends on the particular initial configuration of the initial condition, and also this coefficient K, which also depends on the initial configuration. So that's what you see from numerical simulation. So it's very important if you want to connect these numerical results with the initial condition coming from the early universe, so from inflation, you need to understand how you set up the initial condition in this simulation. In general, because you are considering non-linear amplitude of the curvature perturbation field, you have to consider an asymptotic metric of this form where you have the full exponential e to the 2 zeta, where at super horizon scale, for adiabatic perturbation, we know that zeta is a time-independent function. But zeta is not, it's order one term, and so we cannot just approximate it like one plus two zeta as you usually do in cosmological perturbation theory. So you do, you at the super horizon scale, you can do a gradient expansion technique, which allows you to express all the dynamical variables in terms of the gradients of zeta. So in particular, for the energy density profile, you have this expression. You have the growth factor in front, and then this this expression where you have basically two terms, the nabla square zeta, which is the linear component, which for sure all of you knows, plus the non-linear component, which is nabla zeta square, which when zeta is small, it's a negligible term compared to this, but for zeta order one, these two terms are comparable, so you need to keep both of them, plus this exponential, which basically is a renormalization of the gives a renormalization of the comoving coordinate. But this very more complicated expression with respect to the linear nabla square zeta does not allow to have a simple transformation in Fourier, in the Fourier space. So the nabla square would just transform to the k square zeta. But now you cannot do that, and so you need to stick with the full real space analysis. And then later on, I'll show you how you connect this to the Fourier power spectrum, where you define the in the Fourier space, where you define the power spectrum of cosmological perturbation. The key quantity which used to measure the amplitude of cosmological perturbation is the compaction function, which is basically measuring the mass excess with respect to the background. So it's two the full mass at a particular radius minus the corresponding mass at the same location of the background. At super horizon scale, this quantity is time independent, like zeta, and just given by this expression here. So it's proportional to the first derivative of zeta plus a quadratic correction that can be expressed in this way, where I'm calling delta g this. Delta g is basically is this r zeta is this term here, and then. And I want to stress the fact that this is not a second order perturbation, but this is the full, way of expressing the amplitude, taking into account the full intrinsic nonlinearity coming from the fact that zeta is a nonlinear component. The only assumption that we are going to do here is that zeta is a Gaussian variable. If zeta is a Gaussian variable, r zeta prime is a Gaussian variable, so this term here is also a Gaussian variable distribution, while the full amplitude is in principle never going to be Gaussianly distributed. So with this in mind, the amplitude perturbation is going to give by the peak of the compaction by the height of the compaction function at the peak. And so then you can define, as I proved in this paper that I published a few years ago, it can be shown that all the information of the collapse, apart from minor correction coming of order 1%, which are referred to the tail of the configuration. So all the central distribution, which is the one which is mainly affecting the collapse, are described by a single parameter, which is a parameter basically telling you how the peak of the compaction function is shaped. So it is alpha parameter, which is the second derivative of the compaction function, multiplied by the scale square to have this numerator dimensionless, over four times the peak of the compaction function. In this way, you can write this alpha parameter in a Gaussian component corrected by this term here, which if computing at a threshold, there is a relation between this phi m and alpha g. And in general, what you discover that the threshold goes from a minimum value for alpha going to zero, in the limit of alpha going to zero equals 0.4, to a maximum value in the limit of alpha going to infinity, which is 2/3, corresponding to a geometrical limit when your compaction function is a Dirac delta. The other limit is when the compaction function is basically a top-hat. And there is an analytic fit that allows you to fit all the results, which is the one given here. So here you see basically how in this picture, how the different thresholds for the different shapes of the compaction function are shaped. All this, it's why you so important in understanding the value of the threshold, because if you apply peak theory to compute the abundance of primordial black hole, you discover in the Gaussian approximation of delta being having a Gaussian distribution. So sigma is the variance, where T is the compaction function, W is the window function. So you discover that the abundance of primordial black hole is given by this expression, where the main behavior is given by this exponential to minus nu C squared, where nu C is the threshold computed by the numerical simulation over the variance. Plus you have some coefficient depending on the particular feature of the by the mass spectrum distribution, which is it's a critical collapse. And you see here the Carli K and this gamma coefficient that we have seen already in the mass spectrum. So you see this, because it's exponential to minus nu C squared, this is very sensitive. So a 10% variation already gives a very different answer about the bound. So you can have the abundance vary of several order of magnitude. And so understanding exactly which is the value of the threshold is very important to really have a confident answer about the possible the abundance. And so the cosmological impact of these objects. This is under the assumption of the delta is Gaussian distributed. However, using the fact that there is this quadratic correction that I showed you earlier, you can do peak theory on the Gaussian component and then make a correction. So in other words, basically, you have to basically what you say is the following. You assume, for example, if you assume that primordial black hole describe all dark matter or some component, here I'm making just a toy model example, they describe all dark matter just above Hawking evaporation, then this allows you to compute, given the threshold, which is the amount of P0, which is the peak of the power spectrum, that you need to have such abundance in primordial black hole. And then you can see that for two very different limits, the narrow peak for a direct delta power spectrum, the broad peak, so the different limits of alpha, in the Gaussian approximation, you have that the value of P0 is changing significantly from order 1 to order 10 to the minus 3. So there are 2-3 order of magnitude difference in the value of P0 to have the same amount of primordial black hole, depending on the particular shape of the power spectrum, which corresponds to the shape, to the characteristic shape of the collapsing region forming the black hole. And then with this quadratic expression, you can correct the real value that you, so P0 and L is the correct value that you have to have in the power spectrum with respect to the one that you get from the peak theory in the Gaussian term, taking into account this nonlinear correction. So there is a coefficient of the order 2 that you have to consider to really have the correct amount for the amplitude of the power spectrum. So this all fits very well together, and basically in the end, all these results allowed us to give a simple prescription that for anybody that wants to work on primordial black hole, there is no any reason anymore to do a numerical simulation, because now we have done all the work, and so starting from the power spectrum in zeta, you have to solve just a mathematical program, two simple integral equation, one to compute the characteristic scale of the moving perturbation with respect to the characteristic scale of the power spectrum. This equation gives you a coefficient that enters in this expression, which gives you the characteristic value of alpha, using the fact that alpha has a Gaussian component corrected by a nonlinear term, which is function of this Gaussian component as well. And so in the end, with these few steps prescription, starting from the power spectrum in the Fourier space, you get the value of the threshold in the real space. So that's what you have to do. And in this sample here, you see the typical, for example, how the threshold goes in terms of sigma, which is the variance of two typical Gauss power spectrum forms. So for example, we have considered here the Gaussian form and the log normal form. So, and you see that for sigma very small, you are in the limit of a Dirac delta. So you go up to nearly 0.6, while you decrease. So it's a monotonic function. So and basically, so broader is the power spectrum, smaller is the threshold, so easier is to form primordial black hole. And the reason is because basically, if the power spectrum is broader, within one folding, which is the typical region of the power spectrum contributed to a single to a collapse to a set particular time scale, you have more modes contributing into going into the collapse, and so you can spread the power through more modes, and so you can reduce the amplitude of the power spectrum. So basically, that's the physics that enters in all this. So all this, to my point of view, looks very nice in the sense that now we have a very full picture and a very clear understanding, starting from very first principle, how to compute the key parameter that then enters in the numerical simulation and give the result that you need to use to starting from the cosmological model, you need to know to compute the abundance of primordial black hole. So the typical range of the amplitude power spectrum to have all primordial black hole in dark matter goes from 10 to the minus 3 to 1, basically, depending on the shape of the power spectrum. So something which is much larger than the typical amplitude that you have from the CMB scale, which is 10 to the minus 9, as we know. So the answer is that if you want to have several, lots of primordial black hole around explaining a significant component of dark matter, you need to have a feature in the power spectrum on the scale much smaller than the CMB when these black holes would form. Now, I want to focus, if you don't have any questions, so please interrupt me if you have something you want to ask me. If not, I want to generalize this and go more into what I think a very fascinating possibility, which is assuming the fact that this primordial black hole formed in the way that I showed you, if you consider what happens later on with the history,
may I ask a question here?
Yes, please.
Go to the next part. So you're assuming spherical symmetric collapse, right? So
that's the basic assumption that I'm doing for in all my work at the moment.
Right. So if but if the material has some angular momentum, and then you
well, to a proper. Okay, well, we are in a very early universe, first. And second, we are considering very high peaks in the density because these are the only ones forming primordial black hole. So the spherical approximation, so the typical, there is no proper calculation on this, but there has been some recent work by the group of Antonio Riotto, for example, in Geneva. And what the typical estimation is that the angular momentum of this perturbation is small because it's a high peaks. And also the perturbation of sphericity should not be very large. Of course, as I will say in my conclusion, yes, non-spherical effects could perturb this scenario. We don't expect that the non-spherical effects are going to be large, but because as you see, the abundance is very sensitive with respect to the threshold, even a not so small non-spherical perturbation could be in principle significant. So it's something for sure to look into in the next future. And actually it's something that I'm going to do in the next year. And I have a starting collaboration with people in London to interface my code with their code and try to see if we can really understand more about. At the moment, everything that I've done so far is in under the assumption of spherical symmetry.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. So, if these primordial black holes are around, you expect that they are going to couple in binary system, accrete, and eventually merge and emitting gravitational waves. So it's quite, in particular, if you expect to have some softening of the equation of state in the early universe, because as you saw, the equation, the threshold is of the, it goes like the sound speed square. If the sound speed and the value of W, which are of course related, decrease significantly during the early universe, you expect that the threshold is going to decrease significantly. And so you expect that during some soft in the equation state, you can have a strong enhancement of primordial black hole. And here in this picture, I'm showing the three classical epochs of the early universe before radiation matter equality. Well, we know there should be some soft adequation state. The first one is the electron weak phase transition corresponding to this minimum here, because this is done in the log of the temperature. So the right part of this plot corresponds to the earlier times. Then this region here, which is the most interesting, which is the QCD phase transition, when the free quarks are not anymore able to be free, but they are confined into hadrons. And then the nucleosynthesis, where you have a production of E plus E minus annihilation, which is at the moment is completely unknown which effect would have during the collapse. But in any case, we know that the nucleosynthesis is characterized by a softening of the equation state of this. So this is the scenario I'm thinking, but what I really want to show you is I want to focus to the most interesting softening of the equation state, which is the one, the middle one. So the QCD phase transition, where actually lattice QCD simulation that has been done in the recent times showed us that actually this is more a crossover, because it's not a first order, it's something between a first, second order phase transition. So most strictly speaking, we should call this phase a crossover. And these are the results coming from the lattice QCD simulation. So you have W goes from 1/3 to 0.23 something, and the sound speed to 0.21 roughly. But the interesting thing to note it is in this plot is that the typical mass at the minimum where you expect to have the most enhancement of primordial black hole formation is around the solar mass scale, which is between 1 and 10 solar masses, basically, which is the range where we have interesting mergers of black holes now observed with gravitational waves. So it would be interesting to understand to which extent some of the signal that we observe today, or we could observe in the next future, could have primordial black hole. And so to try to understand that, we have to understand really the physics of the collapse during the primordial black hole. So I've implemented my code with this now numerical equation of state coming from the lattice QCD simulation, and I've computed the corresponding value of the threshold. Here in this plot, you see the percentage change. So there is delta C during QCD over the value at the threshold for different value of the configuration, the initial configuration parameterized by the alpha parameter. And basically here, you have a variation which goes up to a 10% variation, basically, varying a bit with the shape. And this because depending when the perturbation is re-entering the cosmological horizon, now you have an intrinsic scale into the problem. Before, the only intrinsic scale is the mass of the cosmological horizon, giving you the typical mass scale. Now another 3-6 scale is the mass when the cosmological horizon is crossing, when the cosmological perturbation is re-entering the cosmological horizon. This will have a different, the local equation of state at that time will be different, and then the collapse will be different, and so the threshold will be different. And see here you see a plot how the threshold behaves during the phase. I skip this plot because just show that it's not easy to have, it's just a nonlinear effect. It's not easy to have a simple linear relation. But the bottom line that I want to, that this plot tells, if we apply this in the calculation of the abundance, you discover that around the minimum, you have an enhancement of the abundance of three order of magnitude, so order of about 2,000. So it's really a significant, so this 10% of variation of the threshold is produce an enhancement of three order of magnitude in terms of the abundance. So, which is really significant. And another important effect is the computation of the mass spectrum. So now you have to compute that you have to, instead of having just a single critical collapse, like this dashed line for radiation, you have different lines depending when the perturbation is re-entered the cosmological horizon. And fixing the initial configurations of a particular value alpha, which is basically fixing K and the threshold for radiation. Now you have these parameters now are varying basically with the mass of the cosmological horizon when the perturbation is re-entering. And so you see here in particular some numerical fit that we have got for K and gamma. So basically now you introduce another effect. And to show you what this effect produced, it's in, you have to look at the mass distribution. So if here you have the mass function, so the mass function for radiation is this blue dashed line. If you just introduce the modification of the threshold, keeping the mass spectrum of radiation, you have this enhancement of abundance, giving this mass distribution given by this red dashed line, where it's peaked around two solar masses. If you include also the modification of the mass spectrum with the modified critical collapse, now you have this full red solid line with a pile up of increment, so a pile up of smaller masses. So the first order effect is really given by the threshold, but there is a second effect which is not so negligible, which it's given by also the modified mass spectrum. And in particular, this one is very important if you want to compute the full mass distribution, so the full mass function, and then use this mass function, where now again the mass function will depend on the particular value of the tilt of the power spectrum, because depending on the tilt of the power spectrum, you are going to pick up more or less the enhanced effect of the QCD phase transition. So for an S equal one, you are basically keeping most of the effect. So you have this this mass distribution here. And basically, you can see that this dotted line was the typical phenomenological mass distribution that people were considering in the past, before doing this numerical simulation that introduced all the physics of the collapse with this varying equation of state. So the tail of the mass distribution was basically is reproduced, but there is this secondary very important peak around one solar mass, which was totally not seen by the phenomenological mass distribution, which now we are considering. And this full mass distribution, I see that there is a raised hand, please, if you want to ask me something.
Yeah, thanks, sorry. So just somewhat maybe like lost in the previous slide. So just to make sure that I'm following you, are you still putting in a peak in the primordial power spectrum to make these primordial black holes?
Yes, you always have to do that.
Then given that you're adding then, you know, this enormous peak at high K, presumably, I guess, you know, the peak location is chosen, you know, to correspond to the horizon scale at the time of
this. Yes, exactly. Well, you assume to have a peak in the power spectrum around the QCD.
In the power spectrum, right,
scale,
yeah.
Then you have this. However, the QCD scale enhanced, so the peak of the power spectrum is a bit smaller than what you would need to have just in radiation.
Sure. Okay, good. Yeah, so I'm just puzzled why the spectral index matters, you know.
Is important the spectral index? Because if an S is equal one, you are really picking well the effect of the QCDs. And if you start to tilt the power spectrum, the power spectrum itself is basically screening the what happens during the QCD. So it's not able to pick up significantly. However, we know that an S should be order one. So actually, because an S order one is the QCD would really act. But here I'm just showing you that, of course, there is a dependence on the... So if an S is, for example, smaller than 0.8, 0.7, you start to lose this peak that you would get in the mass distribution because of the QCD.
Sorry, I mean, so as NS equals one corresponds to the slope of the, you know, of the nearly scale invariant, you know,
yes,
power law, right, power spectrum, whose amplitude is like 10 to the minus nine. And then the peak
is order one. And then you consider to have at that scale a feature, which is with a nearly scale. And then you should have, of course, you are basically imagining that you have a power. Actually, I'm going to explain you this later a bit, because basically, okay, I can anticipate. For example, if you have an ultra-slow-roll model of inflation, you can have something like a power spectrum with some peak in the very early universe, and then this is going to connect if the ultra-slow-roll parameter are sufficiently fine-tuned, and this, of course, could be a problem, but it's a matter of discussion. You can fine-tune this with an amplitude of power spectrum at the CMB scale corresponding to the current constraints. So it's really possible to have playing with the inflation model, a peak in the power spectrum around the QCD scale with the right amplitude. So that's possible. But of course, yes, as a matter of principle, to produce enough primordial black holes, you need, but there is, I mean, you have to, I think you need to find, let me go on, I will show you that you need to skip the two problems. One thing is assume that you have some primordial black holes around that maybe because the QCD enhanced their formation, if they are around, probably most likely these they are the one forming during the QCD. Another issue is if this primordial black hole explain that matter. So these are two different problems, okay? To explain that matter, you need to have a significant peak of the power spectrum. To have some primordial black hole around, which we could detect, we don't need such a big peak in the power spectrum. So do you understand? This is a key point.
But to make any of these primordial black holes, you still have to have an enormous enhancement of the primordial power spectrum.
No. If I have just a few of them, I don't need to have. For the normal, no, not at all. For just
a few more. No, sorry. So the amplitude of the scale invariant part of the power spectrum is like 10 to the minus 9. And so therefore, I need like some bajillion sigma fluctuation.
Even the 10 to the minus 9 CMB amplitude of a spectrum has give you a distribution of perturbation with a tail. Uh-huh. There are some perturbation with a large enough amplitude to collapse in primordial black hole. Of course.
Sure, right. Okay, good. So how many sigma fluctuation do I need?
These are very rare, of course. It would not be that matter. That's what yes, of course. So the key point is how many are so you have to, as I said, to form some primordial black hole in the universe, you don't need a peak in the perspective. To form some of them.
Okay, so by some, do you mean like order very one small, in the observable small universe, or do you mean order 10 to the minus million in the observable universe?
Small, some very small fraction, very, very negligible fraction, you don't need.
Okay. Depends
what you want to do with this primordial black hole. So that's the point. If you want to just, because really, anyway, if you, in fact, here, for example, I'm considering the fact that what I'm doing is a Bayesian inference analysis, and I'm making a Bayesian inference analysis. We have assumed that we have all the three possible channels of primordial black hole formation. So the power law plus peak astrophysical channel, the neutron star binaries, and binaries done of primordial black hole during the QCD phase transition. We have applied the most updated model of the merger rate, and making Bayesian inference analysis, what we have basically computed the in terms working with the merger rate, the number of events. So in practice, because comparing this with the LIGO Virgo catalog, basically these are this thick, because this is the distribution of events in terms of the more larger mass of the binary. And as you can see, basically, so this is the range of the neutron star mergers. This is the range of the astrophysical black hole mergers. And the green band is the potential contribution of primordial black hole comparing a population of primordial black hole with the catalog gravitational waves that we have. And the answer from this analysis, which is very agnostic, we didn't force the events that we have to be primordial origin, is that most of the events have a very small, basically nature probability to be primordial. But because primordial black holes are not suffering from the mass gap that you have between neutron star and astrophysical black hole, of course, you could have some primordial black hole around the mass gap. And in particular, this primordial black hole, because we have some events where the secondary black hole fall into the mass gap, where the astrophysical model is not very good really to explain, and you really have to stretch as a physical model. So what happens in the end is that there are a few events which are this red, what corresponding to these red ticks. Remember the ticks correspond to the mass of the primary, have a non-negligible probability to be primordial black hole. For example, this event has a 30% probability to be primordial origin. And there is another event I'll show you in the next slide, has a 40%. Basically, there are two, three events, which is an interesting probability among all the ones that we have in the most updated catalog. And this one is the most famous, which has M1 is around 26, 27 solar masses, and the M2 is 2.6 solar masses. So the bottom line answer is that primordial black hole, from our agnostic analysis, can be up to a subpopulation of black hole merger events. Cannot at all explain all the events, absolutely. But potentially they can explain some few events, in particular the few events that we find difficult to explain in other ways. Actually, these are the ones that are more naturally explained by a primordial black hole origin. The interesting thing of our analysis was that we have been able to do a prediction. In the case this event, for example, is a primordial black hole, so this event was coming from a primordial black hole formation, then we expect that during the O4 and O5 runs coming in the next years to have some subsolar events that we should be able to detect. So the possibility to conclude that this event is coming from a formation of primordial black hole is going to be falsified or proved in the next few years from the next future detection. Finally, and then I will conclude, this picture is showing.
Sorry, how? I mean, yes. How? Like, even, let's say, even their subsolar mass primordial black holes based on the mass distribution you compute. But you don't know how they formed. You don't know how.
No, because in the QC, if you have formation of primordial black hole in the mass gap, you also expect to have a distribution on smaller masses.
Yeah, but you don't know how they form binaries, right? So,
no, what so you maybe, mean, you, ex- well, you expect that you have. No, of course. Well, but if they are formed, and there is a sufficient enough some events, they should. What you mean? You don't know how you form binaries.
So, for example, for 1908-14, the other one is like 26 solar mass, right? So maybe it's not a primordial black hole. Maybe it's coming from
No, 26 solar masses can be a primordial black hole. There is no limit in the mass of the primordial black hole.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is the abundance of the black hole, I mean, is one factor. The other factor is how efficient they form binaries, right? So you have these two black holes or stars or whatever.
But of course, there are lots of uncertainties, of course.
And the merger rate also depends on the mass, yeah.
No, of course, there are some uncertainties in what I'm saying, but the point that, of course, there are models that shows that were done, that if primordial black holes are formed, you expect that they couple in binaries. This is a very expected. Also, because we are in the tail of the tail distribution, we expect to have some non-Gaussianity, and we know that non-Gaussianity enhances the possibility of formation of binaries. So I don't think of course, depends how many primordial black holes you form as well. But okay, here we are assuming there is the only assumption that there is a potential subpopulation of primordial black hole around. So it's just in together with other different population channels. In this case, what is the answer? And the answer is that if this is so, some of the events that we observe today have an interesting probability to be primordial origin. Of course, but if this is the case, we should have, because we know the mass distribution of these events, we should have a certain rate of production of subsolar events in the next runs. So in the next future, we will have an answer about this in any case. So maybe we're not. And in fact, here in this plot, I'm showing you the constraints on the fraction of primordial black hole during the QCD phase transition. So this this black line corresponds to the upper limit of this of this green band corresponding to the maximum attribution of primordial black hole during the QCD phase transition in this picture. And so you can see that our Bayesian inference analysis is consistent with the fact that primordial black hole could be up to 0.1% of the whole dark matter in this range. In particular, if one of these two events, which are the two that are most have an interesting probability to be primordial, one is 30%, the one is 40%. This comes from our analysis. Then you will have also a lower limit in the abundance of primordial black hole in dark matter. And this is compatible basically with the current constraints that we have about primordial black hole. Of course, having 0.1% of all primordial black hole in dark matter of this range requires a peak in the perspective. This is very clear, but ultra-slow roll model can achieve it. In fact, if you play with ultra-slow roll model here, this is my last slide, and this is well described in our paper, starting from first principle, you can, this is the distribution of dark of the two peaks of primordial black hole for dark matter. So this is the peak, the small peak of dark matter for in primordial black hole, corresponding to 10 to the minus 3 of omega dark matter. And with enough fine tuning of the ultra slow roll model, here we present, for example, two models of ultra slow roll. You will have a main peak in the asteroidal mass range where we don't have any constraints at the moment, so where in principle it's possible to have all primordial black hole in dark matter. Of course, this requires a peak in the power spectrum order 10 to the minus 3, something like that, to have. But this is actually the main message, is this is a difficult thing. I'm not at all wanting to sell the primordial black hole in dark matter. I'm just saying, if the inflation model behaves like that, it's a possibility, first of all, but nevertheless, even this peak is not a possibility, it's not impossible that there are some events around explaining with a much less amplitude of the power spectrum, explaining some interesting event observation, that we could see or we have seen. So then I'm leaving with my conclusion of course, this is all this is under the assumption of spherical symmetry, but, and as already you asked me, it would be very nice in the future to consider perturbation beyond spherical symmetry. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ilya, for the very nice talk. I think Will has a question.
Hi, thanks for the nice talk. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about how you go from this calculation on, you know, forming isolated primordial black holes and then using that to get some rate for binaries that you then compare to gravitational waves. So, could you just say a little bit more about that calculation? Are you assuming that the black holes then form binaries dynamically, or are you looking for, you know, very rare peaks that occur close to each other that you can form, you know, two primordial black holes that are already in bound systems, or how do you go from the isolated ones to the binaries?
How you get the formation of the binary system? That's what you're asking me.
Yeah.
Basically, well, we don't have a proper calculation about the formation of the binary system, actually, because also a spherical symmetric code will not allow you to have such a numerical calculation. This is something that maybe one can see in the future. So at the moment, what we assume that if there is enough black hole formed, you at some point they move around, because also what you expect that this black hole, if they're around, because you form this black hole much earlier than formation of other structure. So at some point with the evolution of the universe, when the universe become radiation dominated, so the dark matter will fall into it's quite likely to have this primordial black hole start to fall into the gravitational well of dark matter and whatever dark matter is. And so I don't think it's very inconceivable to think that they would couple in binaries. Not necessarily the two binaries should be both primordial origin, although for simplicity we have assumed that. We've started from the assumption that our basic assumption is that if two black holes are formed close enough, because the universe is going to work for a very long time, sooner or later they are going to start to get an interaction, because there is so many foldings. So But the proper calculation about this at the moment is not done. So it's something for the future.
So right now you're just assuming there's some unknown factor, but the number of binaries you have is proportional to the number of primordial black holes or something. But you're not trying to calculate what fraction of the primordial black holes would be isolated versus those who emerge in a Hubble time.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks.
At the moment, that's what we are assuming. Is what we are able to do at the moment, basically.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions? So what about the other mass gap? Do you have predictions for the other mass
gap? Which mass gap do you mean?
The higher mass gap.
No, we don't. Well, for the mass gap, the very large one, you mean, after... Well, that one, of course, does not fall in the region where the QCD have a strong enhancement, so we don't have a prediction about that. So, no, we don't have any particular prediction, because the peak, the peak in the mass distribution, as you see, is around the solar mass. So that's why the QCD phase transition is very interesting for the for binary, where at least one of the two is around one solar mass.
So if, let's say, okay, so if I go back to this lower mass gap object, so if somehow in the future we measure all of them, some we are able to constrain the spin of these black holes really well, and the spin is very low, let's say, the spin is very high. Does it rule out your model?
For sure, because primordial black hole comes definitely out. In any case, they come out with a very low spin. But so if a black hole we measure has a very high spin, it's very difficult to be primordial origin. Or if the physics that we know is at the moment. So we don't, at the moment, our understanding is that primordial black hole forms with a very low spin.
Okay. I think Louis has a question. Yeah.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for the talk. Just for context, I mean, yesterday we were talking about primordial black holes due to a paper that we picked up. Do you have anything to say about primordial black holes and maybe charge, either electrically or magnetically? I mean, just curious as to see where these things might take you if you were to consider it.
Well, I remember just yesterday we had the journal club here. There is a paper with Joe Silk talking about this, if I remember, where they've considered this possibility to modify the constraints of primordial black hole. Well, the question is why they should come with a charge. If you consider standard collapse or standard radiation, I don't see why they should come with a charge. If you put some strange matter, for example, I'm working with a student here, we're considering about collapse of some strange matter modeled by a scalar field, then maybe yes, but we need to have a matter model which allows to have some charge. So at the moment, it's not very clear to me the origin of this charge.
All right, thank you. Just picking the brain of someone who's been working on this much longer. Thank you.
Welcome. But I'm not excluding that it's possible, but I just want to understand from physics where is coming this charge at the moment. I don't see, honestly, in standard collapse of matter.
Thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Ilya again for the very nice talk. Thank you.
Thank you. And